This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show with an important political person in our state. Kelly Armstrong is the sole representative for North Dakota in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's running for re-election, and he joins us to talk about the campaign. Thanks for being with us, Representative Armstrong.
Well, thank you. The position definitely is important. Not sure how important I am all the time, but I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Fair enough. We'll parse it for a few minutes here. As your term in Congress nears an end, your first term, how would you describe the past 2 years?
So it's been obviously pretty chaotic. Started with the longest shutdown in history. I serve on the Judiciary Committee, so we dealt with the Mueller investigation and then obviously impeachment. And now we are in what can only be described as a once-in-a-lifetime health and economic crisis. So it's been a really, really tough and interesting 2 years.
I'd add to it perhaps once-in-a-lifetime political environment as well. Let's talk about the pandemic, first of all, because that's the biggest news in our country, in our state, and worldwide. Why is the pandemic so serious in the United States?
Well, because I think, well, two reasons. One is because it really is a once in a generation, at least hopefully many generation virus. It kind of fits into that sweet spot of significantly dangerous to health concerns and contagious, but also I think the asymptomatic spread and the vast majority of people that contact it and don't have any serious health issues as well associated with it makes it real difficult to deal with in both a political environment, but I mean just in an economic environment and a community environment. So it's got a lot of things that make it difficult to deal with, not the least of which is a lot of people from one end of the country to the other are kind of over it, regardless of where the science is or isn't on a lot of this stuff.
Nevertheless, as I'm sure you're keenly aware, North Dakota is right at the top of the positive tests for COVID-19 and has been getting a fair amount of attention for that position, which it's held onto now for quite a while. Why do you think it's so difficult in our state?
We'll see a lot of this and see how this works out. But I mean, I think we handled the beginning of it, I mean, different. And it obviously is a local spread, and local contact, but I think a lot of it is simply at the time and where it came down and how it has come down. And people, I mean, the American people and the North Dakota people are not necessarily really well geared to stay in their basement for 2 weeks, let alone 6 months. And, you know, there's no playbook for this. And there's criticism to go around at the federal level, the state level, the local level. You know, I have a 12-year-old daughter, a 10-year-old son, two parents who work. My wife actually takes on the role of a single mother a lot when I'm in D.C. So we are traversing through this and have parents and grandparents with pre-existing health conditions that make it difficult to see them in person and those types of things. And so we're traversing this as a family while trying to deal with this from the federal level and the response level. We're dealing with a lot of the same issues that every family across North Dakota is dealing with.
The issue of masks has strangely become political. So where does Kelly Armstrong stand on that?
I don't mean to make light. My first one is my problem with masks is kind of the same problem I have with everything else. I either have five of them or I've forgotten all five of them. I wear them all the time in D.C. I wear them around here. One of the reasons I do is here's the thing. From the data I see, they are effective. I don't think they're nearly always as effective as people think that they are, which doesn't mean they shouldn't be worn at all. What it does mean is we got to be careful that they don't give people false senses of security as well as we're dealing with this. As it regards to mandates, I agree 100% with Governor Burgum in that you cannot do a mandate. And this comes from my time as a criminal defense attorney. Unless you are willing to enforce it robustly, you better be very careful about mandating anything, whether it's a mask or anything else. And so I think, you know, we talk about mandates and we politicize the mandate and we do all of those things. But the second part of that political conversation and policy conversation is whether you are going to robustly enforce a mandate. And if you're not willing to robustly enforce it, you shouldn't do it. That being said, the simple answer is wear a mask. My 12-year-old can wear it in school. The 10-year-old can wear it in school. You can wear a mask. And if for no other reason than if we can get consumer confidence up 20%, your local businesses will do better.
Why is pandemic relief stalled in Congress?
Well, I think the first part of this is have to recognize, well, the answer is because there's an election on November 3rd. But this is also, I mean, Congress came together very well from the administration to Republicans to Democrats to do the PPP program and the first three CARES packages. And I will tell you, I was surprised at how well that occurred, considering the toxicity that exists in a lot of circles in D.C. right now. This last package is obviously, I mean, we could start in a lot of different places. The first three packages had real serious buy-in from all three groups, Republicans in the Senate, Democrats in the House, and the White House. The last CARES package was simply written in Speaker Pelosi's office, and that was kind of where the marker got laid down. And then as you get farther, we have injected all in, if you count the multipliers, $6 trillion, $7 trillion into the economy. And there's a lot of that money that is either should be repurposed or redeployed, which is where that hasn't been deployed yet. It's not money that's already spent and you're taking it back from. And so I think the big difference why this run on pandemic relief is stalled in Congress is first political, because we're now inside of 20 days to an election, and these kind of packages are difficult under normal times, really difficult when one side or the other thinks they're going to claim victory for it. But I think secondly, there are some real significant policy differences as we have come through the rest of this, not the least of which is whether there's liability protection for small businesses, how much state and local money there exists, which is where it's been a little frustrating in that there are certain things we all agree on. One, PPP extension and repurposing some Main Street money that's not being utilized right now should be a simple fix. I know if that was allowed to be voted on the floor, it would pass with north of 350 votes. There's a reason the speaker won't allow that bill to come to the floor.
Well, health care remains a huge issue in this campaign and, frankly, in the country at large. Why is the Republican strategy focused on overturning the Affordable Care Act rather than improving it?
Well, I'm not sure that's I'm not sure that's accurate. I can tell you that the case before the U.S. Supreme Court with regards to the Affordable Care Act is a valid legal case, and it'll be interesting to see where that comes down. And the short version of that is when Obamacare was originally challenged in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court rejected the interstate commerce authority of the federal government. What they gave Congress was the taxing authority of the individual mandate to have regulation over healthcare. When the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed, the individual mandate went away. So the sole reason why the Affordable Care Act was held to be constitutional no longer exists. But when it comes to healthcare, and I said this in 2018, nothing has changed in 2020. This is an absolute bipartisan failure that goes back at least 25 years. And there should be more and more conversations about how we deal with this next. Because the other answer is premiums are going up, pharmaceutical drug pricing is going up. All of these costs have continued to rise in the last decade since the Affordable Cares Act passed.
Realistically, though, doesn't there need to be some affordable health care coverage that is not tied to employment? Because otherwise, if you're unemployed, your health insurance is gone.
Yes, the keys to those. And I think that's an important thing that doesn't get enough coverage. Right? At this point in time, there are not a member of Congress, Democrat or Republican, that ever is going to recommend not having pre-existing conditions covered, those types of things going forward. But the flip to that is there are various different ways in which we philosophically, I'm a big fan of getting the amount of money that we spend on healthcare into the hands of the states and allowing them to do that. And I watched this firsthand during the oil boom, where a lot of our problems were bad debt at emergency rooms, different conditions in healthcare. And the more flexibility and the more abilities you have to do those things at the state level, the better off you're going to be, and pushing those types of programs and moving forward. But whether, you know, Medicare, Part B, there are a lot of parts of these programs that are incredibly important, not just across ideological lines and across the country. One of the biggest problems with the Affordable Care Act is what we did was shift the burden of uninsured. And what I mean by that is we just really kind of moved it up the food chain. It's particularly important in North Dakota because small family farms, local small businesses tend to be the groups that got shifted into the unaffordable category after the Affordable Care Act passed. We didn't do a particularly good job of insuring more people. We just shifted the burden of where the uninsured went, and we need to do a better job with all of those.
Your website says agriculture is the foundation of North Dakota's economy. It contributes over $10 billion to our economy. How much of that economy boost from agriculture is covered by federal subsidies? For example, last year and this year particularly with the pandemic complication.
Yeah, and to be fair, and this is a conversation that as we move with more CARES funding, particularly in North Dakota, a lot of these programs, and we knew this and we continue to know this, didn't fit into a family farm mold in the same way it did for like a restaurant down the street. And it's the unique nature of the farm industry. But what we do have is programs like WIP plus the MFE payments during the trade disputes with China and all of those things. But I mean, when you're talking subsidies, I get a little concerned with, I mean, the political term for subsidies versus what it is. And what I mean by that is crop insurance isn't a subsidy. Crop insurance is something that we have, and because in supplemental crop insurance, we need to be, those programs need to exist. We also need to recognize that farmers particularly don't really have a free market economy in the same way that we look at it in other things. And the reason for that is we don't want people to have to pay $7 for a loaf of bread or $9 for a gallon of milk. And there's real public policy reasons why we don't want that to occur. Also, our trade agreements put restrictions on anything from sugar to wheat to corn to ethanol with our closest trading partners, which impacts them directly. But North Dakota is a very big reason why the United States has the cheapest, most secure food source in the history of the world. And we need to continue to move forward with that. I mean, the programs that exist are designed to not only make sure that we can feed everybody in this country, but also do our part to help make sure that everybody in the world has whatever access we can help them deal with cheap and secure food. And in order to do that in a commodity-based economy, you are going to put some restrictions on certain things that cause problems. And so we recognize how important our farmers are, and we pass public policy accordingly.
Representative Kelly Armstrong is a Republican representing North Dakota in the U.S. House. He's running for re-election against Zach Racknerud. He's the Democratic NPL candidate. Congressman Armstrong, you sit on the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. What has that committee been doing?
So it's important to understand the structure of that committee. It has no subpoena power and no bill writing power. And for those that don't know, the House of Representatives is set up a little differently than other forms of government, in that when you are in the minority in the House, you really are only allowed to participate in the fights that you're invited to. This committee was, just to be honest with the listeners, this committee was set up in order to ensure Speaker Pelosi won the gavel in 2018. And there were political reasons why it was set up. I'm glad we're on it. I'm glad it exists, particularly because I think it's really important that we continue to have the conversation about what the economic cost of Green New Deal policies would be, not just to the state of North Dakota, but to everybody who consumes energy anywhere in the country and the world. And also be able to tell the good sides of our story. I mean, hydraulic fracturing, which is one of the number one targets of the environmental left, has led to somewhere between 2.6 and 3% reduction in global emissions through various different innovations and technologies. And that's before you talk about the 12 12 million plus jobs the energy sector creates in the United States. So we all want clean air. We all want clean water. We all want to protect our environment. I always tell people coming from North Dakota, there are no better stewards of the land than farmers and sportsmen. But we need to do it in a realistic way that allows that actually gets to these target goals without putting U.S. companies at an economic disadvantage in a worldwide marketplace.
Your family is prominent in North Dakota's oil and gas industry. How do you stand on renewable energy and carbon neutral policies?
That's an interesting question. I am fine. I like all of the above energy conversations. My problem is my friends who say they are for all of the above mean they're for all of the above as long as it's not coal, oil, or natural gas. And to that, I oppose those policies significantly. And the reason is simple, is that any realistic metric by any even environmental scientists will tell you that we are going to continue to use carbon-based fuels for many, many years in the future. And the simple reason is that renewables simply do not produce enough energy to take care of the increase in usage that goes on, let alone the baseload. And that's one of the frustrating things about this. Like, wind energy is great. We have, I'm sitting in my office, and the Brady Wind Farm 1 and 2 are just south of me. We have an ethanol plant in Richardson, North Dakota. We're obviously in the oil and natural gas industry, not that far away from coal country. And, you know, we haven't done a lot of solar yet in North Dakota, but it's been permitted. But the reality is that if you are serious about having this conversation, one, we need to recognize that government programs are a and government regulatory environment and incentives for some of this renewables, they don't occur in a vacuum. They directly compete with industries that are vital to the North Dakota economy, but more importantly, are incredibly important to having a reliable and secure energy grid. And what I mean by that is if you can sell wind-generated power onto a grid for less than you pay for it, and you've had 10 years of depressed natural gas prices, and you regulate the coal industry to a place of being counterproductive, that's all great if you're moving things that way. But in February in North Dakota, when it's 20 below for 13, 14 days in a row and the wind doesn't blow, you better be ready to deal with the consequences of that. And that at that time is not an ideological exercise. That's a matter of life and death. So we should be realistic about how we consume our energy, how we produce our energy, and we should work hard to lower our carbon emissions, but we should do it in places that are grounded in reality and not grounded in politics.
You joined the House as its majority moved under the Democrats in 2018. How difficult is it to influence policies as a member of the minority?
On some things, very difficult. I mean, there are just a lot of fights and under any normal Congress that are going to be shirts versus skins. And then under when you amp everything up to Speaker Pelosi and President Trump levels, that occurs a lot. But I will tell you, we've spent 2 years doing an antitrust investigation on the antitrust to big tech on the antitrust subcommittees. And it's been the most rewarding policy work I've done there, because there really is, and there is bipartisan buy-in to work together to figure out what, identifying the problems, which I think a lot of us agree on, and then identifying potential solutions where, you know, we always talk about partisanship like a bad thing, but this is an area where I think partisanship is a good thing, because there's just general difference philosophies between Republicans and Democrats sometimes, and even when you've both identified the same problem, to figure out what the appropriate solution is. And I'll just give you my take on the antitrust side of it. And it's pretty simple, is in our quest to regulate big business, and it doesn't matter if it's banking, energy industry, healthcare, insurance, in the history of doing those things, when the federal government has attempted to regulate big business, we almost invariably hurt small business worse. So that is my concern as we move forward in this tech conversation. But I think more importantly, if people watch some of those hearings instead of the impeachment hearings, they would have a little more confidence in how their federal government works, because I work very closely with the Democrats on that committee. We may not agree on the eventual solution, but it's been a good committee to work on. And then the other issue is obviously police reform. I was very active in criminal justice reform and addiction related crime and those types of things when I was in the state legislature. And that the police reform conversation that has occurred in the last several months has been a place where I think I can actually effectuate very good policy in that urban, rural, Democrat, Republican, man, woman, it doesn't matter. If you're talking about getting smarter on crime and criminal justice and addiction, I want to be in that room.
Let's talk about the coarseness of our political discourse in 2020. The president himself occasionally says he indulges in locker room talk, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any substantial disagreement over the way the president presents himself?
Yeah, I think I say this a lot. I think even the president's supporters, and I count myself as one of those, I think the president has been as good in his administration as good from issues I care about. The First Step Act was the most significant criminal justice reform in the history of the federal government. Between the president, the vice president, and their cabinet, they have spent more time in North Dakota, I think, probably than the last four or five administrations combined. But I think the answer to this is that I think all of us, and this obviously with the president, it's heightened because of his position and because of his use. But I think there's a lot of us that wish he wouldn't send about a quarter of the tweets he sends. The difference is we don't always agree on which fourth they would be. And he has found a very different way to communicate with people in this country. And they chose to elect him in 2016 because of it, because I think outside of all of the partisanship that goes on, whether it's Democrat or Republican, I think one of people's biggest concerns about Washington, D.C. is the view of it as an elitist social club that is mandating from on high, do what we say, and we follow different rules than everybody else. And I think that is probably more so than any reason why President Trump won the election in 2016. Because he captured that, and he really believes in disrupting the political establishment class in D.C. And in that regard, even if I would never use the same language the president would use, I do support him in that endeavor.
Representative Kelly Armstrong, the Republican candidate for U.S. House of Representatives for North Dakota, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Absolutely. This is, it's been an interesting campaign season for everybody. I will say there's two things, like as we walk, I always try to end on something positive. And I think, and I stole this, I think, from one of Senator Cramer's staff that had said something to this effect. One of the best things about COVID is that it's happening now. And that really kind of hit home to me as I just did a video conference with a high school class in social distancing. You know, we could, for as bad as things have been, we are functioning better because of technology and because of the things we have right now. And so we have figured out how to do some of these things. And I think it's driven a lot of ingenuity and advances that are going to be with us forever, even long after the pandemic's gone. And then the other really cool one is people from across, we know this in North Dakota well, but people from across the country have rediscovered the outdoors. And that, I think, is going to be a long-term positive effect for people's health, people's mental health, people's physical health. And hopefully that's the next big conversation we have when we're done working our way through this pandemic, is because what we have found out is we have to get healthier as a country. And I think we've known that for some time, but I think this has brought it home. So overall wellness is something that I hopefully we can get more and more people to strive for.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, a new project, Tell Tale, Dakota Folklife and Stories. It's from the North Dakota Council on the Arts. We'll hear about it after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The demand for distance learning services has grown in 2020. Dr. Matthew Lawn is the state director for the North Dakota Center for Distance Education. It's part of the state's Career and Technical Education Department. He says 161 local school districts have signed up for distance learning. And Lawn says that means CDE has had to bring on more teachers.
I think we're going to be sitting at 87 teachers, which prior to this year, we were at 44.
Lon says CDE is now in what he called round four of hiring teachers for foreign language, art, and music.
We're anticipating that by the time we hit mid-November, we will have brought on, we'll be over 100 teachers. So it's going to be, what'll that be? We'll be right at about 56 instructors we've hired since July 1.
State CTE Director Wade Sick says his agency will be asking the state's Emergency Commission for $471,000 in CARES Act money to help pay for the increased number of distance ed teachers. A pair of large developmental projects will be allowed to seek tax incentives from Grand Forks following action by the council last night. The Beacon would be a $50 million project, a mixed-use development at the site of the former townhouse hotel. It includes three separate buildings that will surround a public plaza. City Administrator Todd Phelan called the plan a game-changer for downtown.
And it really fits well with our downtown development plan that we looked at. When you looked at the town square, how do we drive more activities, more concerts, those kinds of things? I think this has an opportunity to be what we really wanted, we were pondering doing at the town square. This is probably a better venue for that. Obviously, it's going to need some public assistance to get that, just like expanding a town square.
The proposed Memorial Village redevelopment would consist of a five-story building on the site of the old Memorial Stadium. The first floor would serve as the new home of UND Athletics. The upper floors would become market rent apartments. And the price tag of the project, estimated at $25 million. Phelan says both projects would be fully vetted.
For you to approve the pre-application, that this is these are serious projects, so that we can move forward with a more or further due diligence on the financial incentive side. All of these mixed-use projects, whether they're on the UND campus or the ones downtown, they're all mixed-use. They're all going to need incentives. They're all a little nuanced from one another.
The council invited both projects to submit tax incentive applications without dissent. And Republican leaders in the Minnesota legislature have outlined a five-point plan to fully open state schools, churches, and businesses if they win a majority in both houses. They're pledging to allow schools to reopen, along with sports and other activities, and to let local leaders decide on opening restaurants and other businesses. House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd says he trusts Minnesotans to make the right decisions.
This doesn't mean that we don't take COVID seriously. We absolutely do. But we also know that COVID is going to be here for a while, and we can't continue to stop our lives and stop our activities and just wait it out.
DFL State Senator Matt Klein calls that message, quote, anti-science. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Tuesday, November 3rd is almost here. Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. Join NPR for the final presidential debate between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Joe Biden, Thursday, October 22nd at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Trust NPR and Prairie Public for all the important debates in this 2020 election season.
Prairie Public Live Debate Coverage 2020 is sponsored in part by AARP North Dakota.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're going to talk now about a new project from the North Dakota Council on the Arts. It is Tell Tale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories, and joining us to discuss it are the people who helped put it together. Troy Geist is the North Dakota State Folklorist with the Arts Council. Troy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And David Swenson is the president and producer at Makoche Studios in Bismarck. He helped put all these audio pieces together. David, a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Doug.
Troy, let's get going here with the job of a state folklorist. How would you describe that?
It's a job that's quite varied, and most people don't know what a folklorist does, but I work in preservation of folk and traditional culture. So I document traditional life, traditional arts throughout the state, whether it's saddle makers to blacksmiths to Native American storytellers to Sudanese musicians. And we take those materials and we develop exhibits and publications, special projects, and various grant programs to help support that kind of activity in our state.
What is the proper definition for folklore?
Folklore, it comes from an old German word, which basically means, well, folk for people and lore for knowledge. So it's the knowledge of the people. There's a lot of traditional knowledge that is passed down from generation to generation informally. That information that is not typically learned in schools, or in an institutional setting.
Well, this is called Tell Tale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories. When I grew up, of course, there were tall tales. There were Paul Bunyan and Johnny Appleseed and John Henry and Pecos Bill. Is folklore or these tales, is that distinctly different or sort of the same genre?
Well, tall tales falls within the realm of folklore. Folklore covers everything from folk medicine to folk arts to traditional cooking. It covers the whole range of those traditional things that are learned informally and passed down from one generation to another.
David, tell us a bit about Mokoche Studios, because we play a fair amount of your stuff on Main Street. We've had the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor, and I know that you are the host of the Jefferson Hour with Clay Jenkinson. So tell us a bit about your operation.
Well, we're a world-class recording studio located in Bismarck. We opened in the early 1990s. And we do a lot of Native American recording, along with everything from hip-hop artists to grandmas and grandpas that come in and have songs they want to record for their children. So it's pretty unique to be in a studio of this class in the middle of North Dakota, because we have such a varied clientele. If I had a chance to move to Los Angeles and I had a chance to move to Nashville and work in studios. And I'm really glad I stayed here because of the varied amount of artists that I get to work with. And, you know, that walks me right into working with Troyd. I was thinking the other day, Troyd, I can't remember how far back you and I go, but it's decades. And some of the most interesting projects that I've been involved in have come from Troyd and the North Dakota Arts Council. Including this Telltales project, which is ongoing and is just fabulous. It's a great opportunity to speak to elders and learn from them and the people you get to meet. It's just outstanding.
Troyd, how did Telltale come to be?
Well, Telltale is a special component of a program that we have called Art for Life, which seeks to improve the emotional and physical health of elders, especially those in care facilities, through intensive ongoing art and artist interaction. And some of the things that the elders deal with, of course, is loneliness and separation from community. And these kind of things have really a detrimental impact on their health. In addition to loneliness, they're dealing with issues such as dementia or other kind of age-related memory loss. And this project was really developed in such a way to bring the elders together in a group setting to talk about things that they all have a connection with, and that's folklore. And through that connection, they get to know each other in a deeper, more intimate way to help address that sense of loneliness. And then what that group interaction does, when people talk about, for example, Poker Jim, one elder may remember a part of the story, but because of memory loss, may not remember another part, but somebody else at the meeting does. And then through that cooperation, the full story comes out. And then we get to work with wonderful producers like David, who really can put these stories together in an engaging way. These stories and these recordings not only impact and help the elders, but they educate us in North Dakota as to our folk lore and our folk way of life in North Dakota, which we should be very proud of. And then those audios are then also shared with the family members and other people of the elders, so it gives them something new to talk about and to interact about, to again address loneliness and isolation.
Well, you mentioned Poker Jim, and that's one of now a couple of dozen audio pieces that are available that people can go on the website, the North Dakota Council for the Arts website, and click on these and hear these marvelously produced stories. So Troyd set up Poker Jim.
Well, Poker Jim was recorded in an elder care facility in Watford City, which is the area around which this occurred. And it talks, it's a humorous story, actually, about a cowboy who was caught in a blizzard. And we can all relate to what blizzards are like in our state. But this is, again, a story about this itinerant cowboy caught in a blizzard and what happened afterwards.
Most everyone in McKenzie County, North Dakota, has heard the name Poker Jim.
He was an itinerant cowboy, and he worked from ranch to ranch and stuff, and he liked to play poker.
Poker Jim came to North Dakota around the year 1890. He was working on a cattle drive and ended up as a hired hand on the W Bar Ranch. It's remembered well that Jim had a love for two things, whiskey and poker. The descriptions of his character ran from outlaw to gentleman. Truth is, he was probably a bit of both. Working cowboys in the late 1800s made $25 to $30 a month, and it's safe to guess that most of Poker Jim's earnings went into those two loves of his. The winter of 1894 was unusually harsh, and things were pretty grim at the Haydraw camp on the Little Missouri River where Poker Jim was assigned. By February, the camp supplies had dwindled to the point that someone needed to make the 65-mile ride to Glendive, Montana, for provisions. Speculation was that Jim volunteered for the journey, hoping to find a good card game and more whiskey in Montana. It was a three-day journey to Glendive, but spaced along the route at distances of from 15 to 20 miles were line shacks that cowboys used for shelter on rides like this one. Poker Jim made it to the first shack at the Smith Creek Camp. But when he left the next morning, the camp boss reported that Jim appeared to be seriously hungover. Somewhere along the way, the weather and the cold got the best of Poker Jim. He was found 9 miles from the Smith Creek camp, sitting up against a large scoria rock, frozen solid, his horse tied to a tree and gnawing the bark for food. What was found at Poker Jim's last camp told of his final desperate hours. He was a working cowboy, and he understood his situation. Jim rode as far as he could, but when he realized the cold was overcoming him, he stopped and tried to light a fire. There were sticks and spent matches gathered all around him, but he couldn't get the fire going. The men from the line shack brought Poker Jim's frozen body back to the camp, but they knew the ground was too frozen to allow for a proper burial, so the best option was to wait until spring to bury him, and they stored his body up in the rafters of the blacksmith shop. When the crew at the camp changed, nobody thought to inform the new men of the whereabouts of Jim's body. The new crew had poker players too, and one day they organized a game in the blacksmith shed. A fire was started to warm the shack, and the whiskey and the cards came out. More wood was added to the fire.
They got the little fireplace going, and it heated up the place to the point where his body thawed out and drops in on a card game.
Jim came crashing through the ceiling, landing on top of the card table, scattering men, cards, and whiskey. Some say he just couldn't stand being that close to a good poker game and not being part of it. Poker Jim was eventually buried in what is now known as Poker Jim Cemetery in McKenzie County, North Dakota. Later, a group of 9 of his compatriots moved the rock where Poker Jim froze to death to mark his grave.
And that is the voice of Dave Swenson, the president and producer at Mokoche Studios, who's working with Troy Geist, the North Dakota State folklorist, on Tell Tale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories. Troy, so there is a Poker Jim Cemetery, there is a rock there, and so there's an element of truth to all of this, eh?
There is, and that is often what makes a really good story.
Dave, tell us how you adapt these things for audio production, because we hear you, we hear a little music, and we hear a solid script here, and then we hear a bit of that person in that nursing home talking about the story.
Well, I remember the Poker Jim story. You know, it's quite famous in the Watford City area. In fact, I've been up to the Poker Jim Cemetery. It's on private property, but you can see it from the road. And there were you picked a story which I think has way too much of me in it and not enough of the storytellers. But I'll tell you, there were so many different lines that came out of folks during that story. It was great fun. And I have to say, you know, we talked, Troy talked earlier about people in the elder care facilities and what this sort of storytelling does for them. And it's really quite amazing. You know, the most recent interview I did was, due to the pandemic, was done remotely with a Korean War veteran. And, you know, I was hoping that maybe I could get 10, maybe 15 minutes with this gentleman. And at the 1 hour mark, I started to feel guilty for the nurse's aide that was there with the recording gear. They love to talk, and by and large, you get way more than you expect. You know, I can't remember who said the art of a good conversation is learning to listen, and if you listen, they have a lot to tell you. And in the case of Poker Jim, there were four or five informants that kept upgrading the story, I guess is the best way to say it.
So how did you gather the stories? Was it you, Troy, or was it you, Dave, or both of you just sitting with a group of older folks and asking them to reminisce?
Well, Troy really was the organizer for all of this, and he did come to a number of them. A few of them I did on my own. But it was the people at the elder care facilities that really helped us. And if I had a list of names, I'd take time to read it, because we owe it to these facilities and the staff there for setting things up and making sure it happened. But, you know, I think of New Salem here, and, you know, they made a room available to us, and we had, I think, about eight people that came in that we talked to, some of them in a group and some one-on-one. And they would share stories, and, you know, that was the sort of setup that we did. We would plan ahead, and then I'd go out with remote recording gear and microphones and just tape entire long conversations and then bring them back to the studio. And as Skip Wood, your able editor, knows, you go through and you find the bits that work.
Troy, are you looking for more?
Well, you know, I want to add to what David has said. A lot of prep work goes into this kind of work, and the folks at the elder care facilities just did an outstanding job. One of the things that we really looked at doing was, again, we wanted to focus on those things that elders had in common, that they could all relate to one another about, thus develop conversations. So Dave and I would talk about, okay, what kind of folk themes do we want to visit with elders about? So we may go in and talk with elders about folk medicine, for example, and then we will give them examples of what we mean by folk medicine. And then that sparks all kinds of ideas and communication and examples, and they start chiming in. And as one chimes in, the other one chimes in.
You've got a couple dozen now. Are you looking for more?
Oh, yes. This project has been very impactful, I think, with elders and with the family members of the elders. And it's meeting our goals. So we intend to make it an ongoing component of our Art for Life program. So we are currently working, Dave and I are currently working with some elder care facilities focusing on veterans. And we have just a treasure trove of people throughout our state who have these remarkable stories, personal experience stories and folklore-related stories that are just amazing.
Troy, how is it supported? How is this effort supported?
So our programming is supported by state funds from the state of North Dakota. as part of our Art for Life program to help, again, improve the health and wellness of our elders.
So aside from their posting on the Arts Council website, and they'll be played on Main Street too, I hope, because they're wonderful stories, how do you envision these short audio production pieces might be used in perhaps other ways?
Well, I think one of the things that we really want to do is to have them shared between the elders and their family members, to really have that, to facilitate that interaction, which is so critical to health and wellness. Part of the program also involves working with, the Art for Life program also involves working with schools and bringing kids together with elders. So I can see that this project could potentially develop into the utilization of children in this kind of interaction as well. So there's a lot of different things we can think about in terms of using these materials, and you know, whether it's education or health, those are probably the two biggest things that we would be looking at.
Dave, is there a favorite of the couple of dozen that you've produced so far that just you'd like to share with people before we leave the subject?
Oh, you know, there are so many. We've been, just to give you an idea of the scope of this, we've been in Bismarck, of course, Enderlin, Fargo, Jamestown, Mandan, New Rockford, Rugby, Valley City, Watford City. So there are stories in here, of course, about weather. We're in North Dakota. Some great tornado stories, including the 1945 Florence tornado, along with some great veteran stories. We talked to a gentleman who discharged Adolf Hitler's nephew from the Navy. We talked to a veteran who'd been in Hiroshima right after the atomic bomb. Talked about moonshiners and stills throughout the state in the 1920s. So there's just some great, great stuff in here.
Some are just, you know, really poignant, and some are just extremely funny. The ones about moonshining, there's lots of stories about moonshine in North Dakota. Lots of stories about blizzards, of course, which are so quintessential North Dakota blizzard stories. The South is known for blues music. Appalachia is known for fiddle music, things like this. Our area, you know, those are like quintessential folk traditions that represent that area. Our area, blizzard stories. That's our quintessential folk stories, blizzard stories, and for obvious reasons.
Well, remember that as the snow is falling across much of the region today. Troy Geist is the North Dakota State Folklorist, and David Swenson is president and producer at Makoche Studios. They've been collaborating on Telltale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories. And if you want to hear some more, go to Main Street at prairiepublic.org and click on a link there. You'll be, I think, pleasantly surprised. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hey, Prairie Public. I'm Jake Threlkill, host of the Magic City's late night show, Good Night Live.
How's everybody doing tonight?
You know it. You love it. And backed by overwhelmingly popular demand, if businesses had Tinder. You know, Chicago may have had Second City, but we're proud to be North Dakota's third city comedy troupe.
Jake, we're fourth in population.
Nah. Well, good comedy comes from places that have a chip on its shoulder.
Minot's own Dizzy the Clown was recently installed as the president of the International Shrine Clown Association. Dizzy, if you're looking for a side hustle, Minot's looking for a city manager.
So to make up for that supposed tower work in Minot, Prairie Public is sending Main Street's Ashley Thornburg to be a guest on the show.
I work at a nonprofit, so you can definitely afford me.
Good Night Live, Saturday, October 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Original Bar and Nightclub in Minot. If you want to see the most serious comedy this side of the Mouse River,
Sirius,
then join us at the Original. Tickets and information at goodnightlive.com. It's a big show for a small town.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 20th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote.
This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
On this date in 1912, excitement grew as plans were made for Jane Addams to speak in the state. Addams was a well-known suffragist, activist, and social reformer. In 1889, she had co-founded Hull House in Chicago, a secular settlement house. She and other residents provided a number of services that were helpful for the community, including kindergarten and daycare for working mothers, an employment bureau, an art gallery, libraries, and classes in English, citizenship, theater, music, and art. Among her stops in North Dakota were Jamestown, Fargo, and Grand Forks. She was in fact campaigning for Theodore Roosevelt, saying she was, quote, bringing with her the plea that the American nation adopt the religion outlined in the Progressive Party's platform and stand by Colonel Roosevelt in his fight for the people, unquote. However, as she was a suffragist, her visit also stirred great interest among the state's suffrage clubs. The Grand Forks Evening Times noted her political interest, saying, Miss Addams is the first woman to come to the state in the interest of a national political party. At her stop at the Grand Forks City Auditorium, members of the Votes for Women Club were invited to sit on the platform during her speech. Upon arrival, they were provided with Vote for Women badges. 12 girls from the city and 10 girls from the University of North Dakota were selected to be ushers at this event. There was also a reception held for Addams by the Roosevelt Club and the Grand Forks Votes for Women League. In Fargo, Mrs. C.F. Amidon was given great honor when she was chosen by the Progressive Club to introduce Addams at the Fargo Opera House. She also was in charge of reserved seats, which were held for the Progressive and Suffrage Club members till shortly before the talk. Addams had been in Minneapolis prior to her stint in North Dakota, but she took the wrong train, making her more than an hour late for her appearance in Jamestown. But the local paper reported, "The audience remained good-naturedly until the appearance of the speaker. During the interim, there were short talks by North Dakota women interested in equal suffrage, while several Progressive Party battle songs, including the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Dixieland, and others, were sung." This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. Wednesday on our show, healthcare is incredibly complex, and so is the network that oversees it. Years ago, Congress regulated the cost of some prescription drugs. Connecticut Attorney General William Tong is going after violators. On our show tomorrow, he will be the featured guest for the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. And we'll hear about Jasmine Childcare Preschool, which serves kids from 9 ethnic backgrounds and strives to provide cultural competency. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.